back to another episode of Well, It Depends. My name is Derek Doyle, and I'm joined by my co-host, Andrew Barron. Today's episode is being recorded on June 25th, 2026.
The information in this episode is current as of the date recorded and is not intended as financial, tax, or legal advice. You should consult your tax, financial, and/or legal advisors before implementing any transactions and/or strategies concerning your finances.
In today's episode, Jason Nickerson is joining us today, and we're very excited about what he might have some extra details to give us about equity comp and our topic today of risk capacity and risk tolerance. Jason Nickerson is a CFP and an enrolled agent, and he's also the president and CEO of John Allman Associates. In shortened terms, he's me and Andrew's boss. So why are we talking about today's topic? Markets are at all-time highs, and you might be sitting at a very highly concentrated vested position and possibly some equity comp. But there's some things we have to think about other than, is the company that I'm working for a good company? Can I afford possibly losing potential value of a lot of my position in this stock? Today, we're going to be unpacking two concepts that relate highly to this topic. Those two are risk capacity and risk tolerance. So just to define what risk tolerance is, risk tolerance is how comfortable an individual is with the idea of being exposed to potential short-term losses. Or another way I like to phrase it in a question, can I emotionally withstand this outcome? Risk capacity, on the other hand, is the amount of risk an individual can responsibly assume without jeopardizing their financial stability. Another way to phrase it is ask yourself, can I afford this outcome? So there are variables that go with these, like timeline, liquidity needs, and household income stability. My first question for Jason is, when you're sitting with a client who's has a lot of a big position and has done really well with a company and has a lot of company stock, how do those two concepts possibly pull in opposite directions when you're sitting and talking with the client?
Well, some of it is tied to the psychology and the emotional tie from the employee to the company itself, where the sense of loyalty, and loyalty not just I'm going to show up to work every day, but it's bad if I feel bad if I sell off some of the company stock for the company that's done so much for me and my family, that type of loyalty. They tend to perceive that they have much more capacity for risk when it's that kind of tie to the company. And what we try to help them understand is that the risk that they're actually taking is much broader than that. Their salary is tied to it. Their insurance is tied to it. Home value, potentially, different things like that, right? So we help better define risk capacity. Now, I will say that over the years, what we've seen is 20, 30 years ago, there was this undying loyalty, whereas nowadays that has, I would say it's been scaled back, where employees are much more open to liquidating and capturing more value out of the stock when it's available to them. So our work is really around helping define and understand the concepts that you're highlighting and redefine sort of their capacity for risk.
Yeah. And now we're going to kind of get into the meat and potatoes of what is equity comp. Now, there are three types of equity comp that some of our audience members might be familiar with or have exposure to. Those are RSUs and stock options, which could be non-qualified or what we like to call ISOs as the second option. There is a life cycle, I like to call it, of equity comp. And that life cycle includes four possibly distinct time periods. Those are grant, vest, exercise, and sale. Can you walk us through the life cycle from grant to sale of equity comp, and where are the decision points that truly matter when it comes from a planning standpoint?
Yeah, obviously at first grant, but unvested, you know, we're factoring that into their overall net worth and their overall potential risk that they have tied up in that company. But there isn't much we can do about it, right? It's sort of like a future look or understanding of what risk is actually going to shape up to be, depending on trajectory of the stock price. When things vest is when we really start to dial in, what do we do with this stuff? And it links in many ways, not just to the to their investment strategy overall, when we're talking about the risk capacity and overall risk that they're taking, but taxes and things like this, right? So we're trying to look out and be proactive in helping them understand all aspects of what they've been given in terms of compensation. Now, depending on the structure, say with stock options, where you know there is a timeline there of capturing real value. And I would say that the challenge for us as advisors is getting clients to understand that we're not waiting up to year nine, right before it expires. Most stock options expire after 10 years, that we're going to wait until 9 years or 9 years and 6 months, and then we're going to exercise because we don't want to pay the taxes, and we're loyal, and all the we have great expectations because we work there. We know what the stock price is going to do. And so we really try to open up their eyes as to, okay, but let's zoom out. And you not only have stock options, we have restricted stock. And let's look at this as total exposure versus just this one thing, right? And then we try to optimize. So depending on the years, you know, we have to deal with the cash compensation they're getting, like salaries and bonuses. And so let's say it's a good year. And the last thing we really want to do is add more by exercising an unqualified option, which would add to their ordinary income. But they had restricted stock vest, which contributed to this issue. And they say, they look at it and say, well, my basis is date of vest, whatever that is, it's not much higher than that. We have to help them understand, do you realize that you've already captured a lot of value just by being given that grant and now it's vested? And hey, let's sell that off almost near immediately because you're paying taxes on the value of the vesting. So let's capture that value and divest and diversify into something else. We can still let the stock options run. So there is a real balancing act in helping them understand all aspects of what they're given, because it is somewhat complex. And then how to get those things to kind of work together. And again, Derek, back to what you're saying is, as a part of an overall investment strategy, which addresses capacity for risk, actual risk they're taking, things like that. So there are many moving parts, and having the tax advice and overall investment advice is so important.
You mentioned tax, and there's something that I think often gets overlooked in this piece is people look at equity comp and they instantly think of capital gains because we're dealing with stocks. Vest, the one way that I've always looked at it as in terms of a quick memorization thing is vest is ownership. Now you own it. O, ordinary income. A lot of people forget that vesting period ownership comes with ordinary income rates rather than the capital gains. And you get a lot of people who end up owing more because they're not aware of the tax rates and the implications with that specific event. They just immediately think they're getting capital gains rates, even though they haven't owned it yet. So I think that's just one thing to take away is ownership equals ordinary income. And you have to be careful because obviously those rates will be much higher than your capital gains rate for some people.
Have you seen a change in greediness from clients with equity compensation, especially in the last, let's say, 3 years where the stock market's just gone gangbusters?
In some companies, I would say yes. In others, where let's say the older the company is, maybe they've seen that movie before and they've ridden that roller coaster, they've ridden it up, they rode it back down, and now they're back up again. And they're saying, I'm not going to live this one again kind of thing. Or I know my colleagues lived it, I don't want to live it. I think that combined with, you know, they understand, because information is more in our face now, whereas 30 years ago, even it really wasn't, you know, our memories were much shorter back then. Whereas now it's, I know that a COVID can hit or a 2008 can hit again, and combine that with the workforce being more transient, therefore less loyal to holding on to stock. Whereas a generation before, they were kind of born and raised inside the company. And so it created this loyalty, not just to staying with the company, but to owning the stock as well. I would say it is much easier. The static that I think that comes up in these conversations is really around what Derek was kind of highlighting, which is ordinary income versus capital gains. And just, oh my gosh, I got to pay the taxes on this stuff now. So I do feel that diversification, because there's so much media around that anymore, that's not the hard conversation. It's getting to understand tax implications, overall risk, and then you shouldn't put taxes first. The investment thesis should come first. So they understand diversification, but with diversity sometimes comes with a tax bill.
Yeah, to highlight what Andrew's saying, I really do feel like right now we do have that kind of quote unquote perfect storm that is brewing, where you have markets at all-time highs, people's equity comps they are checking are continuing to rise. You have conversations with yourself around FOMO, fear of missing out. Am I leaving potential upside on the table if I'm selling? That leads into kind of the question where it's like, where should someone take a step back and really look at, am I too concentrated in a single position in any person's portfolio? When is it too risky? And especially if it's the company I work for, when do you think is a good ballpark number to take a step back and be like, I have to do something at this point? There's just too much risk right now.
Well, and I think what you're highlighting there is almost that people understand diversification as a requirement when it comes to their equity comp, but it's these other positions that maybe they don't work for that they got in, and now it can keep going, or I got in late and it can keep going even more. I think rules of thumb have been longstanding rules of thumb for a reason, because they work, right? Mm-hmm. So the standard 5% rule of thumb, no position should be more than 5%. I give it leeway to executives of companies, publicly traded companies. I think you have to, because they just have this stuff coming at them, right? Mm-hmm. I look at it as, hey, if I can keep it under 25% in some cases, I'd love it lower. But we've seen cases where people have done nothing, and it's 50 or 75 or 90% of their total investable assets. And it's like, it's sending off the red alert. We got to do something. Mm-hmm. So if it's just normal, I picked this stock or my friend told me to buy this stock and it's gone up and I've done very, very well, I still think that 5% rule, maybe you could stretch it to 7.5% of your overall investable assets. And I think that's the other, what's the denominator in this, right? Is it net worth? Is it investable assets? I look at investable assets as, what do you have in the bank? What do you have in your investment accounts? Most of us still are in the single most valuable asset in our overall net worth is our house. But that's not really liquid. Like, that's not something we're making the same investment decision on as we would a portfolio. So if we're talking about investable assets under that definition, the 5%, maybe 7.5%, if it's a good quality company that's earning real money, real profits, I could see a stretch there. Company stock, if they're getting it fast and furious, you have to allow for that to be stretched a little bit. But again, it shouldn't be, you know, exorbitant.
And we've mentioned taxes a number of times in this conversation, and we're going to now specifically talk about tax considerations for people who might still have equity comp entering or considering retirement. There's a lot of things to consider, one of those being IRMA. Another of those being net investment income and potential estimated tax payments. What are some major, things that someone might have to consider on a tax piece, Jason, if we're looking at maybe a major vest or a mid-year sale that they should start proactively planning for end of year tax planning before that bill comes to them?
You know, I will, anything I say next will come under the guise that the investment thesis still has to come first and taxes second. Mm-hmm. I mean, the tax law is what we have to abide by. The thing we get to choose is, to some extent, is when we pay them, right? But we are going to pay them. You know, I think the things that you mentioned, what we really test for is tax brackets and when we're crossing certain tax brackets. And the intertwining of ordinary income tax brackets versus, say, long-term capital gains tax brackets, I mean, it's certainly important planning. So, you know, we often work with clients from a tax projection standpoint to come up with a number early enough in the year where we can say, hey, our target, if we could plan this perfectly, this is the amount of capital gains that we want to take. And don't try not to go above it. But hey, if the investment thesis, again, being first, if we have to exceed it, we have to exceed it. And then as you move along in life, you know, net investment income tax, Derek, like you mentioned, is a key consideration, but it's just something that we have to pay. If you can plan far enough ahead around IRMA and the additional Medicare tax premiums, or RMDs is another one, right, that we can't control, so that if we are determining when to take capital gains or, you know, we're still working at that time, pre-planning around taking gains, exercising options, and do we take money out of our IRAs or 401ks sooner to avoid much larger RMDs in the future? It is a coordination of all of those things that's important, mm-hmm. I think.
If we're looking, kind of following that retirement piece, just following the trajectory of a normal career, a lot of your comp is going to increase year over year, or at least you hope it does.
Yeah.
So if we're assuming people are retiring and making the most amount of money, taking that equity comp and gearing up for retirement, how do you think about that differently than when people were working? Besides, like you said, the ARMA and things like that.
Well, I think that comes back to when you're talking specifically about equity comp. I mean, again, restricted shares, we can't control the vesting. It's the stock options that we certainly can. Mm-hmm. And I think that highlights the importance of finding those years where you can drop in an exercise where it makes sense, you know, incur that ordinary income that Derek was talking about, and do that by choice, not waiting to the very end, just because we are programmed to delay taxes as much as possible. And if we can't avoid them, then let's delay them as long as we can. And just taking that, understanding that the salary and bonus trajectory is usually from low to high, and then towards the end, our highest salary, highest bonuses. Okay, if we have stock options, maybe that suggests that we exercise those sooner, or some other planning opportunities, right? Like, do we have money in IRAs? And do we want to get that into Roth now, convert to Roth out, pay the tax now? Yes, even during our working years, because it's this balance of, I'm incurring the income tax now, but does it just add more years of tax-free growth onto it? So there's a few planning decisions, but specifically with equity comp, it's only stock options. And we're actually seeing less and less of the option grants, meaning more and more of the choices taken away from us and just more of the restricted grants. So it's sort of like, well, I'm doing what I can in terms of maximizing 401k or other deferred type comp programs, so that when those hit, maybe I'm not feeling as much pain on the tax side.
Yeah. So to wrap things up, Jason, if a listener here today is sitting on a good portion of equity comp that is vested, what is something that they can do right now immediately that can make an impact in terms of a lot of the planning things that we were talking about that are controllable and a lot of the planning things that are not controllable? What's something that they can do right now that could obviously make an impact in terms of their financial plan?
I think one is just general understanding. What do you have and how is it going to operate, right? Understand what is not controllable first. Then start adding in the controllables. And so a lot of the things we bring up, are you charitably inclined? Can we offset some of these big income hits with big charitable contributions using donor advised funds and things like that? Even though there are pieces of our income that we really can't control, there are deductions that we still can't control, charity, probably the big primary one. Long-term versus short-term, it's very basic, right? I mean, we all kind of understand about how often do we really dial into, is this a short-term, is it going to be taxed as a short-term capital gain or is it a long-term capital gain? Given the run-up in the market, people will often see be on the other side and say, hey, I'm ready to liquidate, but then they just fire things off and don't really pay attention. I only had another week until this went long, right? So there's those planning things of tax deferral to retirement plans, charitable deductions or other deductions that we can choose when we take it, the long-term, short-term. Do we have losses sitting in our portfolio that we're just hoping and praying mm-hmm. turn around? Even in this market, they're not turning around. It might be time to say goodbye to them, harvesting those losses. And hey, that might be, restricted shares that you sat on that vested and, they vested at a high point, but it's still, we're over allocated to the stock. And yes, we're going to sell it at a loss, at least on paper, this is what it's going to look like. And that's understanding the dynamics of restricted shares, right? So again, pulling in all the basic things, but sometimes you just need that reminder of those things still work.
Mm-hmm.
I think the last thing just really resonated with me, where especially you've been talking about the growth side, but with things like RSUs, people interpret that as compensation. And I think something about locking it in for a quote unquote loss really bothers them. But if it's needed for cash flow, if you need to make your mortgage payments, who cares if you have a -2% and you want to see things? Yeah,
exactly.
Jason, thank you for taking your time and visiting us in Rhinebeck.
Thanks for having me.
This was our first guest, so it is a pleasure to have Jason as our first guest on this podcast. So I'm your host, Derek Doyle.
I'm Andrew Barry.
And we'll see you guys next time.
Thanks for watching. If you found this video helpful, give it a thumbs up and hit that subscribe button so you don't miss future updates. Looking for more insights like this? Head over to our website at jgua.com for additional resources. And if you'd like to talk about your personal financial goals, we'd love to help. Just click the Schedule a Meeting button highlighted on your screen to book your complimentary consultation. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you in the next video.